Asia group a few years ago, because I felt that Pacific Asia studies, studies of East Asia and Southeast Asia, were not sufficiently well represented within mainstream political studies, political science, as represented by the Political Studies Association. I also was keen to have a grouping that straddled the sort of Southeast Asia, East Asia divide, not least because it seemed important as a Southeast Asianist that we took account of China's rise, and the Pacific Asia Specialist Group aims to bring together people who work on East Asia and Southeast Asia. And I've said from the outset, and I have a co-convener at the University of Durham, Claire Sutherland, that we aim to combine the best of the area studies tradition with rigorous, theoretically informed political analysis. And another thing which we're keen to do is to encourage dialogue beyond the academy with policymakers and with business. And I think we have certainly people from the diplomatic community and UK government represented here today, and that's very pleasing to us. Each year we sponsor a number of panels at conferences, and we have an annual workshop, and we're always pleased to hear from people with ideas for those things, and we have a small budget to support those kind of activities. In terms of today and today's subject, as a Vietnam specialist, there's a certain irony for me that we're meeting to talk about Thai politics today, because Vietnam is holding its 11th Party Congress as we speak. So I've been very bound up with following that. But I'm nevertheless delighted to co-host an event on Thai politics, not least as we look ahead to the election. But I think you know, there is widespread interest from an academic perspective in terms of thinking about evolution of political systems within Asia, but also there's clearly commercial and policy concern and interest about recent developments in Thailand, and I look forward to us talking about that. I'd like to thank Duncan and Peter for agreeing to speak, and again to reiterate that I'm very pleased to co-host this with LSE Ideas. So that's all from me.
Thank you, Martin. Well, to many of you, oh, this doesn't sound good. You may have to turn that off, actually.
Sure.
Yeah, that's it. To many of you, the speakers here need perhaps no further introduction. Nonetheless, that is the task of chairing. So again, on my right, immediate right, Duncan McCargo is the author of a number of books to focus on Southeast Asia as well as Japan. His most recent book, titled Tearing Apart the Land, Islam and Legitimacy in Southern Thailand, won the Asia Society Prize, the Bernard Schwartz Book Prize, and has been widely and very positively reviewed, as many of you are probably aware. He is also recently awarded an honorary doctorate, which he hasn't told me, but I found out anyhow, in Thai studies by the Mahasarakan University in Thailand. He holds several visiting affiliations, including at Columbia University's Weatherhead Institute. And for any of you who want to follow up on the themes discussed here today, there are a number of recent articles in press or already published. Now, Professor Leyland, he has published widely in his field of law, in particular, for our purposes and interest here today, constitutional law focused on Thailand, but also on comparative public law in Southeast Asia. He has also written a number of other academic journal articles, and he's currently, as I said earlier, a visiting research professor at SOAS. He's also an honorary fellow at of the Middle Temple, which in my ignorance I asked, does it have anything to do with masonry? But it doesn't, of course. I know, I learned. You probably know this, being British born and bred, but we're not all so lucky. Now, as you can tell, in combination, they're really a dream team who may be able to present it with a number of nightmare scenarios for the year ahead as we turn to the prospects of political stability and the rule of law in Thailand in the year ahead, which, as we said earlier, is a year when elections are due. Now, we're almost a decade away from the year when Thaksin's party, Thai Rak Thai, won the first landslide election. And I expect that much of what will be said here today will require a serious thought about the kinds of effects and consequences that are still playing out from that election. So without further ado, I'd like to turn the floor to Duncan, please.
Thank you very much, Lotta, for that warm introduction. It's always nice to be back here at the London School of Economics and Political Science, as the late Professor Michael Leifer always used to remind me it was called in its full name. Never been much of a scientist myself, but the political part is certainly one that I'll be able to address a bit. Thanks very much for the invitation from both PSA and Martin and from Lotta and Ideas. It's really nice to be here. I don't think we have anywhere quite as posh as this at Leeds to host these kinds of events. So it's a delight. Talking about the topic is a little bit less delightful, I have to say, than actually being here, because that involves trying to look a bit into the future in terms of what is likely to happen. That's, of course, something that many people in Thailand specialise in. We have a whole profession of Mordu, people whose job it is to try to anticipate what's going to happen next. It's often very difficult when studying or writing about Thai politics even to explain what has recently happened, let alone to say what is happening now. And then when we get to what is going to happen in the immediate future, it becomes really quite challenging. Let's try to think about this with some reflection on what has happened in the past in the hope that that might be a guide to what might happen in the future. Of course, this is Thailand, so the past is not necessarily any particularly good guide to what might happen in the future, but perhaps there's some things that we can look at. I did suggest tentatively three questions. One is really focusing on the Democrats, one is focusing on quote-unquote pro-Thaksin parties, and another on other players. So let me try to talk about those things. And the first question that I mentioned was that of whether the Democrats could win power through elections. Now, you'd think that the Democrats ought to be able to win power through elections, given that they've been in power for about, if I worked it out right when I was on the train, about 8 of the last 19 years, and have come to power on 3 separate occasions. The only problem is they haven't actually won an election since September 1992, when they were the largest party in that election, by a matter of only 2 seats. So the Democrats don't have much track record of winning elections in Thailand in recent years, unfortunately. If we want to go back to a time where they won an election, we have to go back to 1986 with a decisive victory where they beat Chiat Thai Party in those days by more than 30 seats, but they proceeded to hand the premiership back to General Prem, who had been at that time Prime Minister for a number of years. So last time they won big, they didn't actually put forward their own candidate to be Prime Minister. There's something a little bit interesting going on here. If we look at the sequence of elections and what's happened over the past few years, these things tend to get elided in our minds. I've got the sort of fortunate experience of having gone to Thailand on a number of occasions to follow different elections, and they start to have certain resonances of similarity and differences over the years. But if we look back over the past few, what actually happened in Thai elections in recent years? Moving on from the last one that the Democrats won by just a matter of a couple of votes. When I say won, I'm only talking about being the largest single party, by the way, not actually outright winning in each case. 1995, the Democrats were ousted as a result of a no-confidence debate which centred on the corruption scandals featuring the current Deputy Prime Minister, Suthep Thaksaban. The Palantan Party, moral force party of Major General Jamlong Simoeng, about whom I wrote my PhD, pulled out of the government coalition at about 11 o'clock at night in a dramatic moment. I was standing in the room when Jamlong withdrew his party. The Democrat government collapsed and was not able to come back. They were routed by a 7-party coalition that was assembled on the night of the election at the house of Won Sonti Limtongkun, better known in recent years as a major leader of the PAD. Quite an interesting series of developments that was. That government was not fully approved of for a number of reasons. It didn't last that long. In fact, it lasted only just over a year. In 1995, I was doing fieldwork in Thailand at that time, and I said to quite a number of people, it looks to me as though Banhan Silapasha, the leader of the Chiat Thai Party, might well become prime minister, you know, because it seems that his party could be the biggest. And lots of people said to me, oh, no, Achan, it's not going to happen. It's okay, it's not going to happen. And I would say, why could he not become prime minister? They said, well, you know. I mean, he's from Supanburi. He's too short. He's just not sophisticated enough to be prime minister. And then finally, people would start going, he's not got the nod. He's not got the approval from the network or from above. There's some kind of devalidation of his candidacy to be prime minister. But what we saw from that election was that the devalidation, if indeed it was there, and we've never been able to prove it one way or another, was not sufficient to stop the aforementioned Banhan Silapasha from becoming prime minister. And it wasn't sufficient to ensure that the Democrats came back to power after they had lost it in that no-confidence motion. So, what was going on? Banhan could not last in power, but he could gain power. And I think this is a theme that starts to get very interesting. There are a range of forces going on that are shaping who holds power. Some of those forces are electoral. Some of those forces are non-electoral. The non-electoral forces have not yet determined the election outcome very much. What the non-electoral forces do is come along later, when things start to happen in the wake of the election. And this takes on a sort of familiar resonance when we start to look at more recent elections. 1996, after Banhan's government collapses, Chavalit comes into power. He doesn't last all that long because then we have the Asian economic crisis for which his government is blamed. And rather mysteriously, a dodgy faction of Samak Sontonwais, Prachakorn Thai Party. Samak, all these people keep coming back in different guises later on. It's a sort of feeling of deja vu through the whole thing. A dodgy faction of his party defects to the other side and decides to support the Democrats to take over from New Aspiration without an election. So the Democrats come to power, one, without an election, and two, as a result of a manoeuvre by an extremely dodgy faction in another party whom you would not have expected to support them. Does it sound familiar? Yes, it's exactly what happened again a few years later. So, yes, the Democrats came to power, but not through an election. 2001 is the exception. 2001 is the most interesting election in many ways, because that's the election when Thaksin wins a sweeping landslide majority and completes the full four-year term. Amazing. No upset, no destabilization. Except that there was a chance to get Thaksin out, which was in August 2001, on the assets declaration charges, when somebody decided to phone some of the judges and suggest to them that actually we should let Thaksin off this time because it was all going to be too much if Thaksin was kicked out. So it was not that extra electoral forces could not have ousted Thaksin, but they chose not to do so for whatever reason. 2005, another landslide victory for Thaksin doesn't last all that long. Then we start to get into problems. Starting in September 2005, the beginning of the Yellow Shirt Movement, Sonti's protests against his being kicked off his TV program, and then the Tamasic deal, beginning of 2006, and Thaksin forced to stage a snap election in 2006, boycotted by the Democrat Party, and then annulled by the courts. So Thaksin wins the 2006 election, and is then annulled, and we then have a coup. And then 2007, pro-Thaksin parties again win. You might start to notice a pattern here. Four elections, 2001, 2005, 2006, 2007, pro-Thaksin parties win all of them. The Democrats don't win any of them, and don't come close to winning any of them. But in 2007, the PAD protests, some familiar figures from the past, and we see Jamlong come back, and we see Sonti come back, and we see Samak now prime minister. All these people that I was studying in the early 90s have reinvented themselves. Just absolutely fascinating. And culmination is the legal interventions again, and surprise, surprise, a defection from the pro-Thaksin forces and a new interesting character. Ne Win Chit Chorp, I think, is really a figure to watch. Crosses to the other side, and the Democrats come into power in a very similar way to the way in which they came into power in 1997. So history has repeated itself 10 years on. So the Democrats can win power, but they haven't won power through an election since 1992. They've won power through other means. And parliamentary terms have not run to the end of their 4 years, as a rule. There's always been some kind of political accident that came along and stopped that from happening. Could the Democrats win this time? Now, when I was in Bangkok last month, I found the tone had changed a lot from when I was last there, which was in August. When I was there in August, people were saying, Democrats can't win. Pheutai are going to win. There's no way they can dare hold an election yet. This time, I mean, it's clear there's been a shift in people's perception and consciousness, and lots more people will tell you that the Democrats might win, partly as a result of the relatively poor performance, although it's not as poor as it might look, of Pheutai in some by-elections that took place in December, and a perception that the Democrats are pressing ahead with a lot of popular policies, increasing the salaries of government officials, ending the emergency decree in the south in certain selected districts of the southern border provinces, and so on. So the Democrats are on a roll, but if we look back at the electoral map and we look at just how big a majority the People Power Party had. They had 233 seats to the Democrats, 165 in 2007. That is an awful long way to go, even factoring in the defections of people to Bum Jai Tai. Is that enough? Now, when people say to me, don't worry, the Democrats are going to win, is this an example of this magical thinking again? I had the magical thinking in December 2007, a figure who I shall not name, but you would know his name immediately were I to mention it, who was very close to the Democrat Party, said to me, it's the same as the Ban Han conversation. I said, Samak's going to become Prime Minister, isn't he? And my informant said, oh, no, no, he can't become Prime Minister. You know, same thing. And I said, but surely he's bound to, because you can see that the party's got so much support in the North and Northeast, which is where all the seats are. And then my friend said, don't worry, if he becomes Prime Minister, we'll have him out in a couple of months. We've got all the evidence against him already prepared. And that's when the sort of rule of law and the legal issues come in. So there's this tendency to believe that somehow it's going to be all right on the night. And I think this tendency is quite strong at the moment amongst people sympathetic to the Democrats who would like to believe that they can do it. And maybe they can do it. But I still struggle to see how it works out. Of course, there are a lot of debates going on now. Will the constitutional amendments go through, shifting to 125 party list MPs instead of 80? If you go back to the figures, you'll see that a lot of the Democrats' strength in the last election was in the party list seats. That small difference between 80 and 125 is actually a difference of 45 seats. That could be absolutely crucial, because you don't have to win overall. You just have to get one or two more, as everybody knows if you look back to the elections of the 90s. You need one or two more than the next party to have the right to try to form the government first. We're now starting to find out about this sort of stuff in Britain too. It's interesting that coalition politics, which was something we imagined only happened in developing countries and mysteriously on the European continent, are now affecting life right here in the UK, and we see how messy and complicated it is, and we might view the problems of a country like Thailand with slightly more sympathy when we start to experience the delights of coalition rule ourselves. So those are some of the problems for the Democrats. It's hard to see how they can increase their support base beyond where that support base has been before, other than through some kind of shifting the electoral system, which perhaps reduces the number of constituencies in the north and northeast, which remain not natural territory for the Democrats. Indeed, let's be honest, the Prime Minister and members of the Cabinet can't actually really go to large parts of the country at the moment. In the north and northeast, it's very difficult for them even to travel. So we're not in, despite all the talk about return to normality and reconciliation, I believe that Thailand is very, very far from a state of reconciliation. It's still in a state of undeclared implicit tension. We'll hear more about some of these things, I'm sure, when Peter talks. So my conclusion is that even if the Democrats won power through elections, they would struggle to do so. They are more likely to regain power, not through elections, but through some other kind of mechanism, because there are a variety of ways in which governments change in a coalition system, and particularly in Thailand's type of coalition system. A crucial question in all this is when the election is going to be, which if I knew the answer to that, we were hoping, you see, that we'd know when the election was going to be by the time we had this. And I kept saying to Martin, can we just delay it a bit? And he said, no, this is the absolute last possible date. So I was just hoping that we could have left it a few more weeks and then know when the election was going to be, and then we would be talking in a much less abstract way. People assure me that Apisit personally would love to have an election as soon as possible. I have no way of absolutely verifying that. At the same time, T.S. Eliot said in a very different context, April is the cruelest month. April has certainly been the cruelest month for this government getting through the protest season. I talked in the 90s about a protest season which coincided with the hot season, a politically hot season and a climatically hot season. We're experiencing global warming. There's a political global warming which is having some kind of knock-on effects in parts of Southeast Asia, including in Thailand. And getting through April, I think, is a nightmare for this Prime Minister and this government. They'd really like to be able to say, we've called an election, we're going to get through April without having protests again. If they thought they could do it, I'm sure that that's what they would like to do. The question is whether it's really going to work. Despite this new resurgence of optimism, realistically speaking, it's going to be extremely challenging for the Democrats to pull this off. What are the other scenarios, briefly? Another scenario is that we go to the end of the year, because the election, Foreign Minister Gesit came to Leeds in November, and I asked him one question, and one question only, when's the election going to be? And he said, well, it's definitely going to be in 2011. And the Prime Minister would like to have it before that. So maybe it's going to be by the end of the year, roughly December, when we might expect it. There are other possibilities. Let's hope that it's going to be within this year and that Thailand can move on, not that the election is actually a solution, but I think not having an election on this lingering question of the legitimacy of the government is a constant struggle to explain both domestically and internationally. But the thing we should bear in mind, talking about other forces, is my old friend Nawin Chitchob, I did say in an article in The Guardian in 2008, in September 2008, this guy's the guy to watch and he's going to determine what happens. So people said, no, you're exaggerating, you got it completely wrong. And then he did actually change the government in December. So I still believe that Nguyen would like to be Prime Minister, that he would like to be Prime Minister sooner rather than later. Many people will review that prospect with complete horror. Other people will think that it could be interesting. But the fact is that he has a lot of resources, a lot of ability at his disposal. He is not a guy to be written off. Now, don't forget that in May 2012, the ban expires, the five-year ban on Nguyen and 110 other people. The Democrats might like to extend the life of this parliament because they realistically know they don't stand much chance of winning the next election. All the banned politicians from the old pro-Thaksin parties would quite like to extend the life of this parliament so that they can run in May 2012. I hope that I'm wrong, but I suggest that there could be an alliance and a deal done and some excuse come up with not to have an election in 2011. I very much hope that that is not the case and that it doesn't happen. But I do have this fear in the back of my mind that it could suit quite a lot of people's purposes. Stop.
Thank you, Duncan, for throwing us right into the political fray and taking us through a near two-decade period of patterns and dynamics. Now, I'd like to turn over to Professor Peter Leyland, who will focus particular attention on the difficulties, challenges of establishing the rule of law in the face of political challenges. This may be the better one.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here, and I also felt that I could be in Bangkok with this sort of luxury field we're in. So turning to my presentation, I'm not a political scientist. I'm actually a constitutional lawyer. I deal with public law. So I'm going to talk in this presentation about first the role of the courts, and particularly the Constitutional Court, And also, I'm going to make some references to free speech in Thailand in relation to the present situation. I mean, anybody who's looking at Thailand from a constitutional angle, first of all, turns around and says, well, why have there been so many constitutions and so much persistent instability? And I think in our analysis of this situation, I refer to our because I've just completed a study with Professor Andrew Harding, it's crucial for us to make a distinction between the constitution and constitutionalism. Constitutions, for us, only seek to embed a given set of fundamental principles as part of the prevailing system of government. Constitutionalism, on the other hand, may be said to embody a normative dimension. Here, the constitution not only anchors and enforces certain principles, but it also represents a clear set of values. The challenge of constitutionalism is not simply to formulate rules at a constitutional level which embody those principles, things like the conception of good governance, nor is it simply a matter of designing formal checks and balances. Constitutionalism requires the achievement of general conformity with such rules by all the main constitutional actors. Now, the reason I say this over and again is that that is the problem in Thailand. It's not the constitution, it's adhering to the rules. So we suggest that to understand the process of Thai constitution making, it's also necessary to have an understanding of the wider Thai context. So the idea of just looking at the constitutional rules is not really a serious way, not really an effective way of looking at the Thai situation. And in our work, we look at, for example, David Engel, who has specialised in investigating Thai legal discourse, and he draws attention to the fact that you can't just look at the nature of the rules themselves. It's clear whether this if you look at the situation in Thailand, what you're really looking at is things that are going on below the surface. And I think two ways into this. In a general sense, it's been explained by Engel, for example. He says, Buddhist concepts run counter to the whole concept of positive law as a means of resolving what we might call situations of injustice. He has interesting work that he deals with how law itself is applied in Thailand. And this kind of approach rejects the idea of just looking at formal rulemaking. The second thing that I would say is that we also recognise that cultural factors in understanding these questions are multidimensional. Other scholars as well have seen that, for example, patron-client relationships come to embody an ingrained set of complementary values. And this is all to do with the idea of hierarchy in Thailand and the idea that very often people take their cue from people, as Duncan has already said in his contribution, from what's going on. You can't just register according to what's happening on the surface. And I draw attention to these things because when we talk about the role of courts or a constitutional courts, these institutions are all predicated on the idea that they are working on the same basis as you would find in other national systems, and that may not be the case. So I want to next move on to deal with more specifically the law and courts, and particularly a constitutional courts. First thing I'd say is that a theory of limited government can be defended, and I would in fact defend it as a requirement which is necessary to restrict the abuse of power, particularly against the executive organs of the state. So while I don't believe judging can be undertaken by reference to principle alone, a system of independent courts can operate as a stabilising influence. And even somebody who was known, famous professor from this very institution, John Griffiths, said, if the rule of law means that there should be a proper and adequate machinery for dealing with criminal offences and for ensuring that public authorities do not exceed their legal powers, and for insisting that official penalties may not be inflicted save on those who have broken the law, then only an outlaw could dispute its desirability. In other words, an ability to uphold the law becomes a necessary precondition. But this depends, and this is the point that I'm coming to next, on having a system of courts which can be seen to be sufficiently impartial and independent. Now, if we move this to the constitutional, in a constitutional context, one of the key issues has been the system for the appointment of judges and the idea of having a system which is perceived as being impartial. If you turn back to the 1997 Constitution, the real weak point, as far as all the appointment systems was concerned, was that there was a reference point to the Senate, which was supposed to be politically neutral. But of course it wasn't. It was actually very much in the pocket of the Tyrakti, certainly after the beginning of time. And so the idea of having an impartial Senate approving appointments, not just judicial appointments, but other appointments, was undermined. Now, in the new constitution, the 2007 constitution, it is actually a committee of judges that has really the highest, the most important say in the appointment of judges, and the Senate is supposed to just sort of ratify, more like the United States system, what the committee recommends. And this has something to commend it, because a number of scholars who are experts in this field, Tom Ginsberg, for instance, have pointed out that the record of appointing respected constitutional courts works much better where it is professional judges rather than others that has an input in choosing who should sit as judges. So from that perspective, the present appointment system could be seen as a step in the right direction. But the other thing that you can say about the Constitutional Court and also the other institutions that have been created under the Constitution is that they have some kind of status where their financial and other support is guaranteed to some degree. But then we look to the constitutional role of the Constitutional Court, and I want to draw this into the Thai situation because this, I think, also bears upon some of the things that have already been said. Let's look at constitutional courts. What do? They ensure adherence to a new constitution when it's created and its protection against legislative majorities so that they protect things like minority rights. They ensure unity and finality in interpretation, avoiding the possibility of different courts adopting different interpretations of the constitution. And they can be seen as a visible symbol of constitutional progress. The essential feature of the constitutional court-based system of judicial review, whatever name one attaches to the institution as such, and however the meaning of constitutional may differ from one nation to another, is that only one court, the constitutional court, has the authority to adjudicate questions of constitutional interpretation or to review legislation. And this court is separate from the ordinary courts, forming either by deliberate design or as a practical result, a fourth branch of government. Now, notwithstanding these advantages of a codified constitution, incorporating a constitutional court, or for that matter, a US-type Supreme Court, in the words of John Griffiths, the fundamental political objection is this, that the law is not and cannot be a substitute for politics. This is a hard truth, perhaps an unpleasant truth. For centuries, political philosophers have sought that society in which government is by laws and not men. It is an unattainable ideal. Written constitutions do not achieve it. Now, these words did not echo in the ears of the drafters of the Thai constitution. In the introduction to another study of the constitutional courts, it was pointed out, One of the many paradoxes about constitutional courts is that while their creation is usually the result of a perception that they have succeeded in many jurisdictions, their activity is in fact peculiarly subject to the political tensions of the jurisdiction in which they are introduced. And the same applies to the design principles involved. We will shortly observe that a decision which would have the effect of disqualifying a democratically elected government is about the most glaringly political decision that one can possibly imagine. Unelected judges being confronted with having to decide the fate of elected politicians. This is something we've already heard about tonight. So while some tension between politics, law and politics is an underlying theme, the capacity of any court to deal with such issues effectively may be called into question. And we all recall that in the Bush against Gore case, Al Gore won the popular vote, but in the end the court split 5-4 on partisan lines. So it's not just in Thailand. This is a worldwide phenomenon. So in the Thai case, the Constitutional Court is particularly exposed to political pressure. And this is even more true under the 2007 Constitution. Not only is it granted final authority over all matters of constitutional interpretation, validity of legislation, but it also has the final word on impeachment proceedings against holders of public office, dissolution of political parties, which we've already heard about, and the legality of elections. One of the most important innovations of the 1997 and 2007 constitutions were the far-reaching provisions to root out and deal with corruption. We all remember that a battery of watchdog bodies were formed with not only the power to investigate wrongdoing, but also the power to dissolve parties and issue red cards, banning the perpetrators for 5 years, as we've just heard. The recommendations of the ECT, or the Electoral Commission, or the National Anti-Corruption Commission, had first to be ratified by the Constitutional Court. The effect of such a decision could be to deprive not only individual politicians, but also effectively to disqualify the government from holding office. So this is the extreme exposure of the Constitutional Court. Now, the performance of the Thai Constitutional Court. We've already heard about the taxing case going back under the 1997 Constitution and how that court behaved. It actually decided in taxing's favour, and there are many question marks about why and whether or not some of the judges have been nobbled one way or another. I'm not getting into that discussion. All I'm saying about that and all I want to say is it's an example of the court being in an unenviable position for the reasons I've already explained. But I now want to deal with the more recent cases which have just been heard in the last month or two, and where we've seen a repetition of the same thing, the Democrat Party dissolution cases. The credibility of the present Constitutional Court, it seems, has been undermined in November and December of 2010. A series of video clips were first leaked to YouTube, which not only appeared to show nepotism by senior judges in filling vacancies for the court, apparently they were planning how they could get their relatives, planning how they could get their relatives appointed by doing well in an examination. But it also featured a Democrat MP lobbying the secretary to the president of the court in relation to the dissolution cases which were pending at the time. These revelations were just the prelude to the court hearing two cases taken by the Electoral Commission against the Democrat Party on the prompting of the red shirt opposition. It should be remembered that as in the taxing case of 2001, the outcome was of the highest importance. Had the verdict in the first case gone against them, the party faced dissolution and the banning of its executives, including the Prime Minister, for 5 years. The charges in the first case were in relation to the allegations of electoral fraud during the 2005 elections, and in the second concerned an alleged failure to declare, as required by electoral law, donations totalling 258 million bahts. Now, the Democrat Party was acquitted respectively 4-2 and 4-3, some of the judges recusing themselves on the basis that they were on the YouTube tape, apparently. The result in favour of the Democrats was not decided on the merits of the case, but rather on a technicality, namely that the failure of the EC to file the case within the required 15-day limit. Now, this outcome exposed the Constitutional Court to accusations of double standards. In previous cases, the Constitutional Court had accepted a petition outside the time frame, so it didn't seem to follow previous practice. This was against Tairak Tai, and had gone on to dissolve the party and its executives. Furthermore, it was very difficult to see, if you're a legal commentator, why the judges had waited to hear the whole case if they were going to reject it anyway. Judges, it was inclined to... But I'm just surmising, and I'm repeating what I was saying before. Judges are part of the state apparatus operating under a flawed constitutional system, as we've seen, which forces them into making unenviable choices. An important element in these decisions may be no more than judges trying to get themselves out of a tight corner by relying on a technicality. The Thai judiciary, more widely, have on occasion been credited for professionalism and independence. So I don't want to tar all judges with the same brush. The administrative court, for example, has quite a good record for standing up to the government, and I refer to things like the Shin Corporation case, the EGAP case, and the Mat Tar Phut case. Also, in December 2002, almost coterminous with these disqualification cases, December 2010, you will have noticed that 85 PAD protesters were sentenced by the criminal court for 2 terms of imprisonment for charges relating to the seizure of the National Broadcasting Service in August 2008. These convictions might appear to show that the rule of law is being upheld, but unfortunately none of the leaders were convicted. So, on the other hand, you could can question this point. So I would not wish to comment on the YouTube scandal, nor upon the conduct of individual judges. However, given the nature of the constitutional provisions in place and setting the decision against the extremely polarised political situation, it might be suggested that there was an inevitability that the Constitutional Court would be dragged into the political cauldron, and that in turn its reputation would be undermined. There are no quick fix solutions to the present political impasse, but some adjustments could be made to the rules to minimise the chances of the Constitutional Court being dragged into such a controversy in future. For example, one rule that might be changed concerns the disqualification of political parties for the misdeeds of individual members. There was an amendment that went to Cabinet about this only a few weeks ago and was rejected. I'm not saying that people who have committed electoral misdeeds oughtn't to be punished. I'm saying that the amendment should be that the whole party shouldn't be disqualified for the misdeeds of individuals. That's the point. Although this measure was clearly meant to be used to stamp out the widespread practice of vote buying and so on, it hasn't worked and appears unjust, as I've just said. Second, in order to reduce the degree of politicisation, rather than be determined by the Constitutional Court, the jurisdiction of disqualification cases, such as the ones we've heard, of individuals, should go to maybe an ordinary criminal court or some other court, not to the Constitutional Court, because that would reduce its exposure to such influence. Well, I've got more to say, but I'm not going to say it because I want to leave time for discussion. So what I've got to say on freedom of expression maybe will come out in the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And in the interest of time time for everyone to continue in a less formal manner the discussion afterwards at the reception, I would like to actually break with pattern and open the floor directly. So rather than sitting up here and providing further commentary, let's just open the floor and see what kinds of questions and comments you may have, and then we may resume. Well, if you want to gather your thoughts, perhaps I could then ask Peter to say a little bit more about the two aspects you didn't have chance to discuss. Perhaps you'd care to speak about either the restrictions on free speech or the kind of activism in terms of Lèse Majesté and how you see that development.
Right. Okay. Well, basically, what I was going to say very briefly about that, and I will say this briefly, I can't deal with both, but I'll deal with the Lèse Majesté thing. I've just mentioned two aspects of it. The first thing I just say very, I want to stress this very strongly. Thailand is supposedly a constitutional monarchy. And what I think is really seriously wrong about Lèse Majesté, I'm not talking about, there's every reason under a constitutional monarchy why the king should be protected. Because the king can't answer back. Absolutely, no problem about that at all. But the thing that's absolutely wrong about it at the moment and cannot be defended is that it can be used as a weapon by one side or another, or by the army, or anybody who you don't like somebody, you throw a charge of Lèse Majesté against them, and that's it. Because once you're in that quagmire, you can't get out of it. The Lèse Majesté law is so harsh and unfair at the moment that it doesn't allow a person to be properly defended. It doesn't allow the courts to stand aside. It's an affront to human rights. So you can't have a situation under a constitution where people can use the Lèse Majesté law as they are presently using it, because it actually undermines the impartiality of the monarch, who has a constitutional role which requires, in formations of governments and things like that, to perform certain kinds of very delicate functions. And once you have people throwing this accusation from one side or another, you've undermined the whole thing. So it can't go on. That has to change at some point. And the other thing that I wanted to say about this law is that it's being used now as part of a sinister state apparatus in the new Computer Crime Act, which was designed quite legitimately to control abuse of the internet for child pornography or for terrorism. It's being used to shut down opposition, using Lèse Majesté accusations against people, and the state authorities are given draconian powers to go into premises and to seize things and so on and so forth. And again, this is an affront to human rights. It can't continue. And the final thing is that the law itself has to change to allow recognition of the defendant's rights and these sorts of things, which is something I've written about and I think is a very important issue. So that's basically what I was going to say, summarised very quickly.
Thank you very much. Now, the floor is yours. Use it. I see two hands at the back, but I can't see who they're attached to. Yes, please.
Okay, clearly it's a complicated situation now because the yellow shirts, if that is the PAD, of course there's not a complete match between the two things, but if the yellow shirts are the PAD also formed a political party, the New Politics Party, which Jamelon claims is named after the title of a book that I wrote about him. I don't think it has anything really to do with that. So the PAD now have a bit of a problem because they're both an extra-parliamentary movement and a would-be parliamentary party. They will have a little bit of an identity issue in trying to work out who they are and where they are. Clearly, it's likely that that party would only really take seats away from the Democrats. So it's not actually going to boost the number of, in all likelihood, it's not going to boost the number of quote-unquote anti-taxing MPs. So the PAD is going to have a problem in positioning itself. But we can clearly imagine that suppose Pertai and some other quote-unquote pro-taxing parties are able to form a government, which I still believe is at the moment the most likely outcome after the election, if it's reasonably soon, they're not going to like it, and we can easily imagine the repetition of some kind of protest against a quote-unquote pro-taxing government. And By the same token, we can easily imagine that the UDD, the Red Shirts, would be extremely dissatisfied by the formation of a new government led by the Democrat Party, and they would raise a lot of questions about double standards, accountability, the handling of the protests this year, all sorts of things would come back to the surface. So we can. This is the problem, that we're talking about elections as though the issue was about elections, but of course elections are just a kind of external realm in which much deeper and more complicated conflicts in Thai society are playing themselves out. So whatever the outcome of the election, we don't actually solve necessarily the root cause, and we don't get to quote-unquote reconciliation, which I think remains very far away. So I think it's necessary that Thailand, desirable that Thailand should have an election fairly soon, because the lack of an election has created a problem. But we, I'm sure most people are not under any illusions that it's going to be that simple. We can easily see that the election will trigger, or before very long will lead to, as I talked about, it's not just about elections, it's about the interventions, the machinations, and the subversion of governments that takes place after those elections. And I'd love to believe it won't happen again, but if recent history is anything to go by, it's highly likely that we'll get some kind of reaction against the election from one kind of movement or another, or both.
There was another hand at the back, and then yes, please. Could you please indicate to whom the question is addressed?
Yeah, it's another of these questions of trying to guess what's going to happen, isn't it? But it's hard to see that everything is just going to go nice and quiet and sleepy for the whole of 2011. I think there's going to come some point in 2011 when tensions are going to rise, and we can see an increased turnout. The UDD said that they were going to have a couple of sort of mini protests a month or something on a regular basis, and we saw the last one, large numbers of people appeared who seemed to have been bussed in from the provinces, and you have to suspect that something is going on there, that the connections between Pheu and the movement have something to do with that, and that we're seeing those protests partly as a surrogate for demonstrating the strength of anti-democrat or implicitly, possibly, sort of pro-Thaksin feeling in the election. So in a way, there's an acting out that's already starting. Let's hope it's not going to get to anything like the levels of the past couple of years. But we will be very optimistic and if we imagine that nothing like that could ever happen again, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Question here and then over there. Yes.
How did you say you looked at the prospects of both sides acting out against whatever the electoral result might be? You also mentioned the words legitimacy, question of both the constitution elections.
Yeah.
Seeing that the constitution itself was put through in a referendum under military appointed government at the time, the questions of legitimacy and credibility remain throughout the elections or the constitution itself. Do you see any concrete efforts that could be made to try and regain such legitimacy and credibility? Is there any way
My own view is that this question of the constitution is a bit of a red herring. It's symbolic. The 2007 constitution has its flaws. It's less democratic in the sense that the Senate is more appointed than half appointed and half elected. I'm coming to that. Give me a chance. There is the question of the people claiming that one's better than the other and so on. But the point is that as far as I can gather, the Red Shirt movement are using the idea of going back to the 1997 constitution as a symbolic thing, that something has been seized from them, that power has been seized from them, and that they would like to resort back to it and so on. And for that reason, there are people who support that faction. I think that whatever constitution Thailand has, the issue of legitimacy comes from the idea of the factions agreeing to accept the terms of that constitution. And whether a new government, if it came in and sought to reform the constitution, and so on, whether it would make that much difference. I don't think it would, because I think underneath the surface there are these same tensions that are existing. And they're playing around with the Constitution all the time. There were constitutional amendments last week or a few weeks ago to do with the number of members of the Senate and to do with approving treaties and various things. The Thais are obsessed with constitutional changes. They love constitutional changes. They get very excited about them, but they don't make any difference in the end. That's the point I would make.
Yeah. Should we take the next question?
Yes.
Dr. Harrison.
I just wanted to follow up on a couple of points that Peter made about lèse majesté law, when you noted as a sinister state apparatus and as a vehicle to shut down opposition. So I'm taking my cue from a question that was asked earlier in the week at SOAS on International Question Time to David Miliband, but this is specifically about Thailand this time. Is WikiLeaks a good thing for Thai politics? It's a question to both of you, actually.
Is WikiLeaks a good thing for Thai politics, is the question. Who would care to go first?
As soon as you mention WikiLeaks, the microphone suddenly comes back to me. I don't know why that is mentioned. People. Well, I have to confess, I only read the WikiLeaks things before coming here this afternoon because I had a feeling someone was going to mention it, which should reveal to you what I always try to explain, that I'm not actually obsessed with this stuff and I don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking about all these kind of rumours and mysterious intrigue. I don't know. I mean, I do have very mixed feelings about the whole thing because it's quite difficult to get information or reasonably good information about what's going on, especially when you want to penetrate the higher echelons of Thai society and, you know, the network monarchy. Let's cut to the chase. If those people who have been willing to speak out, the likes of the former US ambassador, find that their remarks are summarised, quoted, and then put onto the internet for us all to read, they're very unlikely to say anything to any future US ambassador, and they're very unlikely to say anything to me or to a lot of other people who might be interested in some of those questions. So on the one hand, it's very interesting information to have, and to my mind it sort of confirms things that I've said before, but I do feel, you know, that it's a bit of a mixed blessing, because people have already been getting rather paranoid about talking about all sorts of things, and once a lot of stuff goes onto the internet, maybe it's going to be harder to find out what's really, it's difficult enough to find out what's really going on now, and I don't think this is going to help on one level.
We don't have anything to add. Really.
Can I just come back?
Yeah.
The question is really about the opening up of debate and discussion. So you
right.
have, at the present moment, two extremes where you
yeah.
have closed down information
right.
and censorship
yeah.
erupting in the form of WikiLeaks, but
yeah.
not very much in between.
Right.
Of opening up the possibility of debate and discussion,
that's right.
which to me seems absolutely essential if there's any way of moving beyond the incredible divide that currently exists.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, the impossibility of having sensible public conversations about things that everybody in Thailand is talking about in private makes it extremely difficult to move forward any kind of process of reconciliation, political reform, and a whole lot of other things.
I agree with that.
Absolutely true.
Yes, please.
I'd like to ask the panel about the Bill of Time, because I think both of you made the reference that it's pro-taxing, it's pro-mention. But in my limited judgment, it seems that Bill of Time is a very different town from Thai Ak Thai, for example. And I'm wondering, one conversation I had recently suggested that actually Bill of Time wasn't in power. It might actually form more of a compromise between both of the other people realise, partly because Pua Thai is not meant to be as populist or at least as mentioned in populist tax consultants, and also because there are individuals in Pua Thai who apparently at least are a lot more establishment, the older speaker, than most of the civil rights appear to be. And in particular, I refer to one consultant who I understand is deputy leader of Pua Thai.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. It's not completely clear who is running Pertai. Obviously, these parties are factionalized, they're decentralized, they're getting different bits of funding, there are different interesting individuals in them. But, you know, on the one hand, I may be regarded as a principal promoter of the idea that there are two power networks in Thailand, but, you know, it's never been remotely that simple. I mean, there are always people on both sides who are talking to the other and who could almost as much be in either camp. So we don't want to get too reified in our categories. And obviously all politicians, pretty Nguyen is a classic example, could be on either side. You know, who financed the Temasek deal? Siam Commercial Bank seems to be coming to mind in all this. I mean, there is not a straightforward, clear divide between these two networks. They're profoundly overlapping, and not everybody who is quote-unquote on the Pertai, quote-unquote red side, is profoundly radical or critical or anything of that kind. I didn't get to say what I was going to say about Pertai. I mean, the reason why it might be a good idea to have the election now, if anyone's listening, is, of course, Pertai has a leadership problem and a coherence and identity problem at the moment. And that may be part of the reason why the Democrats seem to be very actively flirting with the idea of a snap election and a quick election. Because Pertai, precisely because we don't really know exactly what's going on with Pertai, and they don't seem quite to know what's going on. So in a sense, the longer they have, the more solidified and coherent around a particular leader the party becomes, the more of an electoral challenge or threat to the Democrats it might be.
Thank you. We have one hand up, and then there may be time for possibly two, three quick questions, and then we should wrap it up. First in the back, please.
Since I've followed this, and we have in our audience Jamie, who probably knows more about this than me, but I think that there have been quite a large number of convictions under the Act, as far as I can judge, and there have been some fairly long sentences, but I don't have a record of the precise number of cases. All I've got are isolated reports. And the problem with the freedom of speech thing that we've talked about before is that I don't feel that I've got any reliable way of knowing how many cases are going through the courts at the moment. So you find the isolated thing you may find it in The Nation or Bangkok Post or somewhere else, but you don't get any sense about what the situation is. I've got sort of secondary sources which suggest that there have been a large number of confiscations. We do know about that and entries into premises, but we don't know, or I don't know anyway, how many convictions there are, but I suspect there are quite a few. That's all I can say. Well, as far as the defending of themselves is concerned, it's very, very difficult. This is something that I was going to say, that under the Lèse Majesté law, one of the difficulties is that if a person who's representing somebody who's accused of Lèse Majesté does so too vigorously, they themselves can be accused under the same law. And this is one of the reasons why this law must be reformed, because it doesn't allow a person to have a fair trial. So once you have an accusation of Lèse Majesté directed at you, it's quite difficult to escape from it, even if, in a normal sense, you would be considered not guilty, because it kind of sticks. I mean, there are some famous examples. David Streckfuss's book, which has recently been published, charts a large number of cases historically where this has happened, and it's very, very disturbing.
There there was the prior question on the growth of IT and related communications and its impacts on politics.
I have a feeling you might know more about it than I do. I'm not on Facebook, I have to admit, so I'm a little bit, you know, I'm just, whether it's generational or whether I'm just one of these dysfunctional technophobic academics, I haven't fully got my head around social media yet. Someone please come and talk to me who'd like to do a PhD on this. I mean, what's very interesting is that there always has been a parallel universe in Thailand and in many other societies where things can't be talked about in public, where people are gossiping about them. And they're also, in the past, they were circulating them in bike blue, you know, these leaflets that would be distributed in the Sanam Lu and would be mysteriously posted up on notice boards or left in the marketplace. And what's now happened is that that parallel universe has entered the social media, and there's just a vast explosion of what was already there, taking on different forms and morphing into new things. So it's not that it wasn't there before, but I think social media creates...
That's the curiosity, how it's changed.
Yes.
How it's uploading and how it's
yeah.
keep tabs.
Yeah. Keep right. And it's a massive project, and somebody needs to do it, and not me just yet, because there's so many other things to do, but it's very clearly very important.
Okay, we need to wrap up. Was there one more hand? Yes, there was in the front, and that will be our final question. Please.
I'd ask the way it is for Professor Mercado. The way you were talking, I wanted to ask, do you believe the relationship between voters and political parties is the same as it was in the 90s and before, or has it changed?
Yes, well, that's another bit of my talk that I never got to give, actually. Yeah, how far have things changed? I mustn't go on too much, but basically... people have been trying to write off certain things. Factions don't matter because Thailand now has a two-party system. Wrong. Nguyen proves that to be completely untrue. And I think a completely reincarnated post-Thaksin Pheutai party, if it came to being, would demonstrate that further. Vote canvassers, Hua Kanair, and I had a PhD student who worked on this. I still believe that electoral outcomes are largely determined in many places by the influence of vote canvassers or work in N, and that vote buying and use of money remains extremely important. It's deeply unfashionable to say this. Some of my dear friends are very upset with me for continuing to repeat this. I still believe that a lot of people's votes are crucially influenced by their relationship with vote canvassers, and that the success of pro-Thaksin parties lay in their successful capture of vote canvasser networks, which doesn't have to be a lasting thing, nor do I believe that, you know, the red shirt movement and Pheutai and so on are representing some profoundly deep ideological divide in Thai society, nor do I think that they represent the poor farmers, and I could go on, but this takes me into a whole new presentation that I haven't really got time to give.
Right. On that note, for what was it? Future research, PhD
yes.
students, solicitations, and at least two rounds of roundtables ahead. I would like to draw this to a close. Would you please join me in thanking our speakers for helping us to map some of the quite crowded political terrain and the, at times, perhaps confusing turning of chairs in the political fray, but also, I think, very importantly, to link this to the rule of law and the very real challenges this has faced in a way that goes beyond red herrings and particular case studies and provides a more more comprehensive overview of certain key patterns and dynamics. So many thanks to Professors Leyland and Macargo, and